This meeting of the House of Labor and Commerce Committee will come to order. The time is 3:21 p.m. on April 1st. Members present are Representative Carrick, Representative Freer, Representative Sadler, Co-Chair Fields, and myself, Co-Chair Hall. We have a quorum. Please silence your cell phones. We're asking that staff and members of the audience not approach the table. If you need to pass a note to committee members, please get the attention of my committee aide, Joan Wilkerson, and she will take care of it. I want to thank Andrew Magnuson, the Labor and Commerce Committee Secretary, and Renzo Moises from the Juno LIO for tech and teleconferencing support. We did have an agenda change with today's committee meeting. We are no longer hearing today HB 324 about virtual currency kiosks, and we are no longer hearing today HB 292, insurance pediatric neuropsych disorders. So with that, we have one governor's appointee who is online, and we have three bills on the agenda. So starting off with the governor's appointees, I'm going to turn to Ms. Jennifer McConnell. She is an appointee for the Alaska Labor Relations Agency. Ms. O'Connell, would you please put yourself on the record, share some information about yourself, and also your interest in serving?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity. I greatly appreciate it. My name is Jennifer O'Connell. I'm an HR professional currently employed with the Providence Health System. I'd like to thank you for considering me for confirmation onto the Alaska Labor Relations Agency Board. If confirmed, this will be my second term on the board. As you can see from my resume, I've worked and supported labor relations in various levels and capacities throughout my career. Involvement in the board, it does provide me with the opportunity to stay connected to labor relations and the public sector now that I am in the private sector. And it allows me the opportunity to give back to my community. So thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Ms. McConnell, and thank you for your interest in serving. Are there questions from the committee? We have a question from Co-Chair Fields.
Through the chair, you mentioned a two-year focus to reestablish productive labor management relations at Kodiak Providence. Could you provide a little more detail about that and what were the problems that you were trying to solve and how did you work on solving them from your perspective?
Yeah, I'm very happy to through the chair. At that time, it was, I want to say, right around the start of COVID, there had been some contentious labor negotiations that were happening at the time between the union and management at that organization. And it led to a dispute that was going to result in a strike. The union did vote to strike. Ultimately, they chose not to due to the spreading of the COVID-19 at the time. And I was hired right around that time. I had had quite a bit of experience working with management before and unions as well. And so there was, I'm trying to think back to the exact details, but at the time there was a communication breakdown between management and the union. And so there was a lot of focus that I spent on upskilling management, on labor management relations. What does that look like? Putting some context there, we put into place some labor management meetings that helped rebuild that open communication between the union leadership and management leadership. And as that relationship and trust was rebuilt, that enabled us to have more productive labor contract negotiations. We did ultimately initially do a one-year extension, then another one-year extension before we agreed to another three-year contract.
I have more questions, but other members may.
I'm not seeing additional questions from other members, so Co-Chair Fields, please proceed.
Okay. If I might ask a follow-up, so under your current job as senior HR program manager, what do you mean by enabling more effective labor management across the seven state system? Like, what does that mean in Alaska?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So, how to best describe this? there was quite a bit of inconsistency on the various tools that we had available, and also inconsistency in the labor knowledge of the various individuals that would support labor management relations. And that work revolved around getting the right tools to the right people in order to have those conversations. So what that means for Alaska specifically is helping ensure that our HR business partners, who are the ones that work every day with our operational leaders and are the ones that interact and coordinate with the unions, that they are upskilled in the areas where they may have some lack of labor knowledge, and they have any resources that they may need to be able to, you know, successfully have those conversations and work through any relationship challenges that may arise between a union and management.
Follow-up, Coach Fields.
Yeah, through the chair. Were you involved in the increasing the number of patients to nurses and some of the units, some of those increases that have occurred over the last year? I think it might have started at Four North and gone to some other units.
That is not something I was involved in or have any information about.
Okay. Yeah, I guess I don't have more questions at this time.
Okay. I am not seeing further questions from the committee. So with that, thank you very much, Ms. McConnell, for your interest in serving Alaska. We appreciate you being here today. I'm going to take a brief at ease so that we can take so that we can sign the committee paperwork. We are back on record. The remaining bills on the agenda today are HB 285, Health Information Exchange, by Representative Mina. We also have SB 211, Extending Occupational Licensing Boards. That is a Senate Labor and Commerce Committee bill. And we also have SB 89, Physician Assistant Scope of Practice, and that will be presented with Senator Tobin. So with that, we're going to go to our first hearing on HB 285, Health Information Exchange. And this is a House Health and Social Services Committee bill. The bill will be presented today by Ms. Katie Giorgio from Representative Mina's office. Representative Mina, I believe, will join us when her schedule allows. So if you could, Ms. Giorgio, please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hall. For the record, Katie Giorgio, staff to Representative Genevieve Mina. She sends her regrets. She's tied up in another committee right now. Thank you for hearing House Bill 285, which is a House Health and Social Services Committee bill on the Health Information Exchange. I will just do a brief introduction and sectional analysis if that is the pleasure of the chair, but I will be turning over most of the testimony and questions to Kendra Stick, who is on the line. The Health Information Exchange is basically a platform on which electronic health records can be shared. And in 2009, the federal government passed the HITECH Act. And what that did was mandated that states adopt electronic health records, hence needing causing the necessity to have health information exchange put into statute. Now, 2009 was a few years back, and a few things have changed since then technologically. And so what we're looking at in 285 is to modernize our statutes around the health information exchange and some of the key provisions include just general updates to clarity. And one of the things, too, that I really appreciate about House Bill 285 is there's a governing board over the HIE, and it will be adding a seat for a behavioral health provider, which is something new for that governing board. And I think it's incredibly important as we move forward as a healthcare system in Alaska that we have behavioral health providers at the table governing the health information exchange. I'll also note that not really reflected in your packet, but as we're all aware, the Rural Health Transformation Program, we're in our first year right now. The first round of applications are being processed, and there were almost 1,800 letters of interest submitted for the first round of RHTP. And while I have not seen the contents of any of those letters yet, I do expect several of them at least to be looking at how we can modernize how we do our electronic health records. And if we were to pass House Bill 285, that will help enable more of these projects to be successful, I believe. So this is a critical piece of infrastructure for our healthcare providers and for patients. And with that, I'd be happy to go through a brief sectional analysis or whatever you would prefer.
Please proceed, Ms. Georgiou.
Okay. So briefly, the sectional analysis. This is version N of HB 285. Section 1 refines the language around the basic functionality and uses of data in the health information exchange. Section 2 is repealed and reenacted, and this regards the designation of the qualified entity as well as the roles and responsibilities of the designee. Section 3 is amended to clarify procurement provisions for both the department and designee to seek both private and public funds. Section 4 is amended to update the makeup of the governing board. These changes include, as I said, adding a behavioral health provider to the board, as well as adjusting the two non-voting seats. Previously, both were representing the University of Alaska, and this change would retain one of those from the UA system, but the other seat would be sort of a general other stakeholder or community member. Section 5 refines how the department consults with the designee on system development, applications for funding, and identifying ongoing sustainable funding mechanisms. Section 6 is amended to refine and strengthen the security and privacy provisions of the HIE and clarifies those duties between the department and the designee. Section 7 is amended to clarify the definition of system to exclude elements that are not directly a part of the HIE. Section 8 is added to have a stronger definition of the term designee, and Section 9 provides for an immediate effective date. And that concludes the sectional analysis.
Thank you, Ms. Georgiou. Question, Co-Chair Fields?
Through the chair, could you explain the difference with the reenacted Section 2, which I guess is structurally a little different than what's on current statute? If I'm reading it correctly, the under current statute, the designee may be a private, for-profit or nonprofit, and it has some detail about who's on the advisory board. And I think that that level of detail is taken out in this repealed and reenacted version. And what's the sort of thought process behind that? Thank you.
Madam Co-Chair, if I may maybe defer to Kendra Sticka, who would be able to speak to that more eloquently than I could.
Great. Thank you. And actually, we have Kendra Sticka on Teams here. Ms. Sticka, would you prefer to answer Representative Field's question first, or do you want to provide your invited testimony first?
Happy to do whatever is preferred. Happy to answer the question.
Okay. Please proceed.
And for the record, Kendra Sticka, I'm the Executive Director of Healthy Connect Alaska, which is the state-designated health information exchange. Representative Fields, the language change just moved. The statute just lacked clarity in what was the responsibility of the Department of Health and what was the responsibility of the designee and the entity who was delivering the health information exchange. So it really moved language around to increase clarity there, more so than actually changing any of the responsibilities. It provided clarity, and so the advisory board, the governing body now in Section 4, still has the same membership as was outlined with the addition of behavioral health provider and shifting the non-voting member to include someone who could represent a community of interest. But it doesn't change the intent or content of what the responsibilities are. It just provides clarity.
Okay. Thank you.
Oh, actually, I'll wait for that's what I
thank you. Thank you, Co-Chair Fields. Ms. Sticca, could you please proceed with your invited testimony?
Yes. Thank you for inviting me to speak on this. Really, I think what the highlights have been covered in terms of this statute change is largely intended to make the language clear and make it very clear how the health information exchange can be used. A huge issue with sharing very personal and private health data is to make sure there's trust around sharing. I think we see that in, you know, both state law, of course, but federally, nationally, all of the places. And for trust to be built, I think there has to be very strong clarity in the language. And so this bill really gives that clarity. So when people are using the health information exchange, it's very clear how the data can be used and how it cannot be used. So really I think the key highlights that have been brought out in terms of changes is what we just talked about in terms of clarity and what the Department of Health is responsible for and what the designee, so at this time Healthy Connect Alaska, is responsible for. The addition of the behavioral health seat is a critical piece. Also provided some language just about public health as an allowable use explicit in statute, where it's only been in regulation before. Again, it doesn't change how the HA can be used, but provides clarity there. Also clarity on limited allowable use for limited healthcare operations. So just providing, again, parameters there that are clear for everyone who's using it. One other piece that was added at this point, the use of the health information exchange is very narrow, intentionally so, for treatment, care coordination, allowable public health use, and payment, which is aligned largely with HIPAA. The statute change would allow, if a patient wanted to, for them to direct their health records from the HIE to be used for some other purpose. That would be absolutely optional. And only if the patient wanted to do that, but it could provide the opportunity to allow Alaskans to have their health data that's already consolidated in one place in the health information exchange be sent, for example, if they wanted that information to be used for determining disability benefits, that there was a medical condition, those sorts of things. So essentially to provide some efficiency and decrease the burden on the individual Alaskan to gather up those records from so many places. So again, to be clear, that's just an option, but there would then be the legal framework to build out the technological capacity to do that. So those are really the key pieces. As was mentioned, it's just the statute is quite old relative to how health information technology and EMRs have advanced, so the language became somewhat unclear just because of the advancement in technology.
Thank you, Ms. Sticca. With that, we will turn to questions. We have a question from Co-Chair Fields, followed by a question from Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair. Yeah, I mean, the bill changes seem like a good idea. I just wanted a little more institutional background. So in the statute, it says the department shall, or the commissioner shall designate a qualified entity. How did that happen the first time? Has there been a change in the designation? I assume under the statute, the commissioner could designate a new entity if that made sense. Just a little background on that delegation would be helpful. Thank you.
I think I can speak briefly to that.
Please proceed, Mr.
So, thank you. Through the chair, initially the Healthy Connect Alaska, previously Alaska eHealth Exchange, was designated. I do not know exactly how that designation happened originally. However, in 2023, prior to that, there was an RFP issued. And so at that time, and I came to the organization after that time, but at that time, Healthy Connect Alaska responded to the RFP. So the current mechanism has been through the RFP, which was awarded to Healthy Connect Alaska to administer that.
You guys can follow up.
A follow-up question?
Is Healthy Connect Alaska a 501c3, or what is the nature of your organization?
Yes.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the co-chair. I got distracted, but I think it might have just been almost answered there. How is the Health Information Exchange currently funded? And then I have a follow-up question.
Thanks for the question. Through the chair, we have currently a contract with the Department of Health for the vast majority of core services, and then we have additional services that we have fee for service to organizations for those particular services. So a combination, we are currently about 90% funded through our state contract and the remainder from various services that have a fee associated with them.
So I have a follow-up, too.
Follow-up, Representative Carrick.
Through the co-chair, thank you for that. On Section 5, I see we're requiring the department to ensure the system becomes self-sustaining through user fees and other funding sources. Can you talk a little bit about how that might be envisioned? Is that just through increasing some of those fees, or is there another method envisioned for that right now?
Through the chair, thank you for that question. Really, I think where that lies in the Health Information Exchanges nationally, quite frankly, have had really an interesting path in terms of determining where that financial sustainability, how that is realized, what's the responsibility of a state, what are the responsibilities of individuals using the Health Information Exchange. So I think really how we're envisioning that at this point is that there's a portion of the Health Information Exchange that is really part of core health infrastructure for the state of Alaska. So similar to other utilities and things where that infrastructure needs to be in place for the industry to operate. So in this case, the healthcare industry. So looking at that portion that the state supports in that way. Then there are state services such as Medicaid is a huge budgetary component where the Health Information Exchange can be a really valuable tool and technology for them to have efficiency in the Medicaid services they provide. So in terms of state funding, I think it's that balance of what the state looks at as core healthcare infrastructure and then what they see as the Health Information Exchange serving as an economical, efficient way to disseminate some of their programming. Parallel to that, looking at where there are value-add services that healthcare organizations may be interested in paying for because by having that shared infrastructure, it can be done in a more efficient way. The rural health transformation projects was brought up, and while this statute doesn't necessarily doesn't directly impact in some ways, I think the types of projects that people are pursuing around the RHTP program, for example, value-based care, alternative payment models, the Health Information Exchange can really serve as a key data infrastructure there and provide efficiencies in those systems. So as we build those out, I see that being some of the pathway towards the financial sustainability.
Okay, that's helpful. I have a separate question.
Representative Carrick.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And just on a completely separate question, in Section 4 about the composition of this of the board, I'm seeing in subparagraphs A through I, paragraphs 3 and 4, we have some voting members and some non-voting liaison members. Those members in total add up to, looks like, 6 hospital, tribal health, insurers, behavioral health, University of Alaska, and other stakeholder. And then the board itself, or the governing body, is 9 members. So can you talk a little bit about composition and the voting? Are the non-voting members part of that 9? And then also where do the others come from? Or could you just talk about that composition a little bit?
Yes. Through the chair, thanks for the question and clarification on there. So the 9, all of those 11 make up the board. So the 9 voting members that are the A through I organizations that are represented or organizations, but industry types in healthcare that are represented, and the two non-voting members. So the University of Alaska non-voting member gets recommended for appointment. The board votes on it, but recommended by the University of Alaska Board of Regents. The other additional member, the shift was added to have more flexibility and one more non-voting member, as we have looked and seen how healthcare changes, needs change, and sort of current salient issues, I guess, that come up to the Health Information Exchange has really, it seems like it would be very helpful to have someone who represents a community that has a position that would necessarily need to be on the board all of the time, but maybe for several years. So for example, right now there's a lot of work around how do we look at social care and community-based organizations who are meeting those social care needs. While that's not a designated group, their perspectives would be really valuable to how we look at services that the Health Information Exchange could potentially provide or connect those services together. So that's where those two non-voting members, one being University of Alaska, one being at the discretion of the board when those more timely issues, I guess, come up, where there'd be representation from someone from that area. But all 11 of those members make up the board, the 9 voting and the 2 non-voting. That was clear.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Do other members of the committee have any questions for Ms. Sticca? Okay, I am seeing none. We also have Ms. Eliza Muse online from the Department of Health. She's a Medicaid program specialist. So we have the Department of Health recognized here as well. Not seeing further questions from the committee, this bill was noticed for public testimony, so I will open public testimony. Is there anybody in the room who'd like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we will go online, and we have someone online to provide public testimony, Cormac Sukram. If you could please put yourself on the record and start your public testimony. Welcome.
For the record, my name is Dr. Cormac Sukram. I'm calling from Bethel, Alaska, and I work as a physician providing care in a rural setting. Prior to medicine, I worked for over 5 years as a full-time software engineer, and I've now spent 13 years practicing medicine. I've also worked in other states where health information exchanges are functional, widely adopted, and well integrated into clinical care. I appreciate the legislature's continued efforts to refine the role of the statewide HIE. This is critically important for improving care coordination in Alaska. However, I want to emphasize that the primary barrier that we're facing today is not just lack of technology infrastructure. Often these health systems already have the ability to exchange information, but do not. The issue is participation. From a clinical standpoint, this optional participation has real consequences for patients. For example, just yesterday I had a patient who underwent duplicated testing because two providers did not have access to each other's records. I also routinely see patients after emergency room visits, including high-risk cases such as stroke, where timely follow-up is critical. In many of these situations, the clinical information in or from the ER visit isn't readily accessible, which delays care coordination and referrals to specialists. In another recent case, lack of access to prior diagnostic information contributed to delays in referral to oncology and a poor outcome. These are not isolated incidents in rural Alaska. This is a systems-level issue that affects patient safety, where coordination across large distances is essential. I'll communicate with Anchorage, providers in Juneau, providers in Seattle. As currently written, the bill focuses on encouraging participation in Section 1. It does not address situations where organizations may choose not to participate or may limit access to information. Based on my technical and clinical experience here, I would strongly encourage consideration of clearer expectations for participation. This could include minimum participation standards, especially for entities that share patients, and requirements to exchange key clinical information during transition to care. Health information exchange will only be effective if participation is not only supported but expected. In my experience, without clear expectations for participation, voluntary systems like this are unlikely to achieve the level of adoption needed to actually improve patient outcomes. Without that, we risk continuing to build infrastructure that does not meaningfully improve outcomes. I thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Dr. Sukum. We have a question from Co-Chair Fields.
Thank you, through the chair, to Kendra Sticka. What would language look like that would meet the suggestion of Dr. Sukum? And, I mean, this was an issue that I think testifiers talked about in the HES committee, and, yeah, it seems kind of obvious to me a health information exchange is fairly worthless if there's not actually the information and you have to reobtain it, and then a patient realizes they need it, but they didn't authorize it for the last person, so you have to redo a test. I mean, that does nothing for the system, right? So what would it take? I agree, we should be obtaining this information, and what would that take in the bill? Thank you.
Ms. Sticka, before you respond, are there any committee questions for Dr. Sukum?
Well, I was kind of hoping he would respond to her answer.
Okay.
If that's okay.
That is fine. Not seeing any questions other than Co-Chair Fields for Dr. Sukum. Ms. Sticka, please proceed.
Through the chair, thank you. There certainly could be essentially mandate language for mandating participation in the HIE. Some states have done that. I think, you know, mandates, that's probably a bigger, broader discussion, and as we all know, have pros and cons. I think the point is very well taken that a health information exchange is only as good as the data within it. I would say within the past 6 months to a year, we have made substantial progress with organizations on a voluntary basis, particularly some of those high volume hospitals with some of that critical, emergency room hospital stays, those pieces of information that really are very time sensitive, as was mentioned. I appreciated the testimony and agree entirely that it really is the intent of the health information exchange, and when one is working optimally, that it does the non-duplicative tests, that patients, you know, what they need is delivered in time. So we haven't talked about drafting language around, you know, mandating participation. Again, there are certainly other states that have examples of that. Many states don't. I do think we're making very good progress, and particularly in some of the tribal health and rural areas, making some really good progress with moving forward with integration and some additional organizations, including some of the tribal health, the large tribal health organizations participating. So I don't have specific language, but absolutely agree that the data needs to be there for it to be of value. I think we are getting to a place of a very strong data repository and a couple of integrations, we call them, data coming in that aren't live yet, but I think that are in progress of that technical work will really help enhance it as well.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Follow-up?
Is there a way to structure it where the default is we obtain this information and make it very difficult for the patient not to provide the information? So basically allow them to, but make the default of sharing the information much easier so that we have a higher rate of participation. Have you examined such an option, perhaps in consultation with stakeholders?
Through the chair, for clarity, organizations have to choose to join, but patients have the opportunity. Their data, if an organization joins the HIE and sends us data, it happens in the background once that technology connection is made to their electronic medical record. And so in their privacy practices, just like when you sign HIPAA privacy practices, when you go to a provider, they would provide information about the health information exchange being a data source. And then that data would automatically flow in for that patient unless they opted out. So at this point, the patient's data does come in unless the patient chooses intentionally to opt out. So I do think that's an extremely important aspect, and that's currently in place.
Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Sticka. Dr. Sukum, do you have any comments based on this discussion?
I'd say I greatly appreciate the efforts of the HIE members, and I agree that I have seen progress in the community and talks at HIE will be adopted by local tribal health groups. However, problem with that is what I've seen in the past is they can easily opt out anytime in the future. So I would, in terms of language, you could establish minimum participation requirements for entities receiving state funding or participating in Medicaid, including connection to the statewide infrastructure of the exchange. You could require exchange of core clinical data during specifically transitions of care, including referrals, admissions, and discharges. You could create a defined process for addressing situations in which access to shared clinicalization is restricted or revoked, because we don't have specific rules as to what happens when a system decides that they don't want to participate anymore. And additionally, we could require periodic reporting on participation metrics, including connectivity, data exchange activity, and gaps in participation that I see firsthand where if there are technical issues with an electronic medical record system, they may go ignored by a health entity where information is not being exchanged for a time. However, if it was required, maybe people would or systems would allocate those resources much quicker.
Okay. I appreciate the suggestions. I think my ask for the bill sponsor, Ms. Stickin, Dr. Sukram, if he's interested, is, I mean, can you all talk about some stronger language here to try to drive participation so that we're investing in this infrastructure. We might as well get maximum value out of it. And for consideration as a possible amendment, please.
Ms. Sticker, do you have comments?
Sorry, through the chair, just to confirm, so the question is, could we develop some language that talks about some level of mandating participation or incentives around that?
Say
or
strongly.
Maybe incentives isn't quite the right word.
Yes.
I'm sorry, what's up?
Through the chair, strongly encourage. Make it very difficult not to participate. Yeah.
So, could put language, and this is always just a tricky, you know, who and how that is mandating. And I think, as was mentioned, there's different ways to encourage participation. I mean, a broad mandate, every organization has to do that. Minimum data sets would be another way. Tying it to various forms of payment, I think, is another avenue. I'm happy to take that back. I think it starts to get into where I'm not sure where my, I think that some of that to some extent is then the Department of Health just deciding, you know, that's probably who would be enforcing that and looking at that and deciding what levers, if you will, that they have. I'm happy to, facilitate conversations around that and what a potential amendment might look like.
Yes. Through the chair, that is what I'm asking for, because I think you have a better sense of your stakeholders and partners than I do, and I would just appreciate you facilitating that at the request of a committee member. And, you know, I'm not asking you to take that on as the mission of the HIE, but I think there would be a public good in higher participation, as the doctor suggested, and I appreciate you trying to help us navigate at least language to consider.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Happy to do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Fields. And I want to remind the committee that we still have public testimony open. Dr. Sukram, do you have additional thoughts you'd like to share regarding this topic?
No, that's all. I appreciate you all's efforts.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Sukram. With that, seeing no other folks online to provide public testimony and seeing none in the room, I'm going to close public testimony. With that, are there additional questions for Ms. Giorgio or Ms. Sticca? And again, we have representation from the Department of Health, Ms. Eliza Muse on the line, who I may have mistitled previously. She may also be a data specialist. So are there additional questions from the committee for these folks? Okay. Seeing and hearing none, I'm going to take a very quick at ease. You're back on record. With that, we are going to set the bill aside and set an amendment deadline for 5 p.m. on April 7th. That is Tuesday, April 7th. Okay. We are going to move on to our second bill on the agenda. That is SB 211, Extend Occupational Licensing Boards, by the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Senator Bjorkman's staff, Conrad Jackson, is here. So, Mr. Jackson, please join us at the table. Introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation. Thank you. Welcome to the House.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hall. Good afternoon, members of the committee. It's good to be back. I did spend about 12 years in this room. So, Senator Bjorkman extends, for the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Senator Bjorkman and the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Senator Bjorkman sends his regrets. He's unable to be here today, but here I am. So, Senate Bill 211 is a pretty basic bill. I think we're all familiar with the sunset extension process. This is the opportunity for the legislature to review the actions and process of various boards and commissions as they go through and approach their sunset date. It also gives you the opportunity to review actions of the support agency, the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. Senate Bill 211 proposes to extend six professional boards: the Board of Professional Counselors, Marital and Family Therapists, the Psychologist and Psychological Associate Examiners, the Real Estate Commission, the Board of Certified Real Estate Appraisers, and the Social Work Examiners. This bill is a little unique from some that you may have seen in the past. The most recognizable is the fact that there are six boards being extended. This was just, I guess, an expediency matter. There is a section, Section 8 of the bill, that exempts this legislation from Title 44 that does prohibit that. So we're just trying to move some bills a little more expediently through the committee process. The other piece is found in Section 7 of the bill, which requires two reports to the legislature by the first day of the next legislative session by the legislative our legislative auditor, and that is in regard to compliance with the recommendations for the Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associate Examiners and the Board of Certified Real Estate Appraisers. From there, Madam Co-Chair, we have Mark Lindahl, the Deputy Legislative Auditor, here to speak to the committee regarding the audits and their findings. We also have Director Sylvan Robb in the audience for questions, or if you'd like to have more information on the fiscal note.
Co-Chair Fields has a question.
Quick question, through the chair. Does this cover all the remaining boards that we need to address this year that are not otherwise addressed in separate legislation, i.e. the more complicated interior design bill? Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, the architects, engineers, and land surveyors are not included in this extension. We have, as far as I know, these six are the only boards or commissions who are sunsetting this year.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. Yep. With that, we'd like to proceed to invited testimony with Mr. Lindahl.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Lindahl. Please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation. Welcome.
Okay. Good afternoon. Thank you for having me here. For the record, Mark Lindahl. I am the Deputy Legislative Auditor with the Division of Legislative Audit. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here to brief the committee on the results of the sunset audits we performed on the six boards that are being extended by SB 211. Kind of an overarching conclusion we had for all the boards was that they serve the public's interest by conducting meetings in an effective manner. They adopted or amended regulations as needed. Excuse me. They licensed the regulated professions in accordance with state law. However, that being said, we also had found areas for improvements in each of the audits, and the length of the extensions that we recommend were based kind of on the results of the audit and the severity of the areas for improvements that we found. With your permission, I think you all have copies of the audits in front of you in your meeting materials. If it pleases the co-chair, I would be happy to go through the individual audits and go over kind of the areas for improvement that we identified.
Please proceed.
Okay. The first report in your binder should be the Board of Marital and Family Therapy. This audit recommends that the legislature extend the board's termination date 8 years to June 30, 2034. If you turn to page 5, we have an exhibit 2, which is the standard licensing statistics. As of January 2025, this board had 116 active licenses. Next is on page 7, exhibit 3 is our schedule of revenues and expenditures. And that shows that as of January 2025, this board had a surplus of $197,000. The audit identified two recommendations, which begin on page 9. The first is that the Office of the Governor's Boards and Commissions Director should work with the board to identify potential applicants to fill the vacant board seat in a timely manner. This board had one of two public board member seats vacant for 32 months. Vacant board positions can really impair the board's ability to conduct business. It increases the workload of the other board members, delays investigations, and may result in canceled board meetings due to a lack of quorum. This is a finding that is that shows up in each of in five of the six boards need to fill vacancies timely. Recommendation 2 is on page 10. We recommend the board ensure the renewal licensing application is sufficient to monitor compliance with teletherapy-related continuing education. The teletherapy continuing education requirements are relatively new and apply only to licensees that practice remotely or that provide services remotely. This audit found that the board has no way to identify which of their licensees are subject to the teletherapy continuing education requirement, and therefore they were not tracking compliance with the requirements. If you look at page 19, that's the beginning of management's responses to the findings and the conclusions. And the Office of the Governor, the DCCD Commissioner, and the Board Chair all concurred with the report's conclusions and recommendations. I can pause in between for questions if anyone has a question about a particular board. If not, I can move on to the next.
Please and thank you. Do committee members have any questions for Mr. Lundahl? Seeing none, please move forward.
The next is the Board of Social Work Examiners. This audit recommends the legislature extend this board's termination date 8 years to January 30, 2034. The page 6, exhibit 2, has the board's schedule of licensing activity. This board has 1,299 active licenses as of January 2025. The schedule of revenues and expenditures is on page 7, exhibit 3. We concluded that the board fees were not set at a level that covered regulatory costs, but general fund allocations prevented a deficit. This audit has two recommendations, beginning on page 9. First, we recommend that the boards and commissions director take steps to ensure board seats are filled in a timely manner. One board seat had been vacant for over a year, and another board seat had become vacant after we began the audit, which left two of the five board seats vacant. On page 10 is our second recommendation. We recommend that the board chair and DCBPL director work together to ensure renewal applicants comply with continuing education requirements or seek a regulation change if deemed necessary. DCBPL's online renewal application directs licensees to certify that they have successfully completed required CPE. However, the regulations require that licensees report specific information regarding the courses taken, instructors, dates of attendance, and other details. Management's response to the audit begins on page 21. Generally, the Office of the Governor and DCCD's Commissioner concurred with the recommendation. The Office of the Governor noted that three applicants were reviewed for the board seat. However, none of the applicants were suitable for the appointment. The board chair also concurred and noted that board vacancies have led to delays in processing applications, in canceled meetings due to lack of quorum, and delays in closing out investigations. I can move to the next. Mm-hmm. Next is the Board of Professional Counselors. The audit recommends the legislature extend this board's termination date 6 years to June 30, 2032. On page 5, Exhibit 2 shows the board's schedule of licensing activity. This board has 1,676 active licenses as of January 2025. On pages 6 and 7, we concluded that fees were not sufficient to cover the cost of operations, and fees were not increased in a timely manner, which resulted in the board operating with a $210,000 deficit as of January 2025. According to DCBPL management, a fee analysis was performed to determine whether or not to increase fees. The analysis that they performed supported increasing the fees, and the fee analysis was presented to the board in the September 2024 board meeting, at which time they approved the increase. However, the fee increase was not made due to noncompliance with a new fee approval process. If you look at page 19 of the audit, you'll see a memo from the governor's chief of staff, and per this memo, any new licensing fees must be approved by the chief of staff with input from OMB prior to the request being made. OMB requires requests for fee increases to be submitted to the department's admin services division, whose staff would then submit requests to OMB for review. Once received and approved by OMB, they would forward the request on to the Office of the Governor's Chief of Staff for final review and approval. This audit found that DCBPL staff sent the board's fee increase request to DCCG's admin services, but due to staff turnover, the request was never forwarded to OMB. So the fees were not increased, and the deficit is expected to grow.
Representative Freer.
Thank you, through the chair. Is that so the fees continue to have still not been increased? Is that correct? Is that what you just?
Yes, the fees have not been increased.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair. This memo from December 5, did that only impact the Board of Professional Counselors, or did it impact other boards that we have under consideration here?
This, through the chair to Representative Carrick, this memo impacted two boards, this board and another board, but only indirectly did it impact the other board. There was consideration by DCBPL management on how long it would take to go through the overall approval process. So they decided not to submit their fee request for this particular board and decided to prioritize other fee increases related to new license activities. So it was kind of a management decision not to go through the process. So I would call it indirectly related to this memo.
I have another question.
Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the co-chair. So I guess a little related for all of these boards before us. There was an administrative order, which number I'm going to forget right now, but the one that was on decreasing volume of regulations, 360, thank you, sorry. So did administrative order 360 impact the regulations produced by any of these boards?
Through the chair to Representative Carrick, I would have to do a little research on that. I can't answer that off the top of my head, but maybe DCBPL's director might have more information on that.
It looks like Director Robb does have information that she can share on this question. Thank you for being here, Ms. Robb.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. For the record, Sylvan Robb, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. Through the chair to Representative Carrick, what you see reflected in these audit reports was not impacted by Administrative Order 360. That was issued by the governor on August 5th of 2025, and that was not – it was beyond the audit period for all of the audits that you're reviewing right now.
Quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you, through the co-chair. Ms. Robb, would you anticipate that in our sunset reviews this upcoming year, I'm not sure which boards are up, but will we see impacts to that would be reflected in the audits for this upcoming year's boards? So not the ones before us, I understand, because it wasn't within the scope of the – I'm just wondering if that's something to anticipate going forward.
Through the chair to Representative Carrick. So Administrative Order 360 did impact the entire executive branch in terms of reviewing regulations, and so you should see some of that, but and I don't want to speak for Deputy Director Lundahl, but the audit reviews typically contain a longer period, and so there's will have been an opportunity for boards to amend their regulations, and additionally they have created and submitted and have approved plans for changes to regulations moving forward in compliance with AO 360.
Follow-up, Representative Carrick?
Just a comment, I guess. I think we are going to see the impacts of that in the audits upcoming. I understand why we're not seeing them now, but I just know that that process of regulation review and rescission is heavily staff-intensive for other boards and commissions, and so I would just anticipate that, and I'm a little shocked here in this memo about the chief of staff approving any new increased fees, taxes, or revenues. I hadn't heard about this, so I'm just a little taken aback by this memo and by the impact that it seems to have directly had on the boards that we have, a couple of the boards we have before us. So just a comment, I guess.
Thank you, Representative Carrick. Not seeing any other questions from committee members, I have a couple of questions, and I'm not sure who is best to answer these. But I'm wondering in general, how often are fees increased?
To the chair, for the record, Sylvan Robb, we have about 400. There's almost 500 professional licensing fees. We did a review over the past 10 years. In a typical year, we adjust fees about 67 times. And so fees are adjusted when that's necessary based on the expenses for the program. So we do conduct a fee analysis every year for each of our 45 programs to determine if we need to adjust the fees and then undertake a regulations project. Statute does require that our fees be contained in regulations to make that change.
Okay. My second question is, how often do we, and this might be a question for Mr. Lundahl, I'm not sure, but how often do we find ourselves in this situation where we are at a deficit for these licenses?
excuse me, through the chair, or to the chair, Chair Hall. It's hard to quantify that, but occasionally we do find deficits. This year there were two boards that had deficits, two out of six. I could get more information back to you if you would like more on historical information on deficits.
That would be helpful for the committee's awareness and for contextual background. So thank you. And Director Robb, did you have anything you wanted to share?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So the division does have carry forward language in the budget for professional licensing fees because all of the professional licenses are good for a 2-year period. And so all of the programs have a high revenue year during the year of their renewal and then a lower revenue year when they don't have renewal. And we try to maintain about a year's worth of expenses for each program in order to allow us to cushion any unforeseen impacts to program costs so that we try very hard to keep program fees stable so that they're not ping-ponging around and so that our business owners and licensees can prepare for those. So we do occasionally find ourselves with programs in deficit if they incur an unexpected large expense. Typically that's related to an investigation, which is why for several years we've been trying to do a fund source switch related to investigations to take that very volatile piece out of the license fee setting equation.
Okay. Do other committee members have questions? Representative Carrick?
Thank you, through the co-chair. I know we've passed it, or we're about to pass it. I think it was the Board of Marital Therapy and then also the Board of Professional Counselors. Were those the two boards that had unfilled seats, either currently or during the audit proceedings?
Through the chair to Representative Carrick, the five of the boards had vacant seats. Okay. The only that did not is the Real Estate Commission.
Okay, I have a follow-up there, too.
Follow-up?
I'm just, through the co-chair, I'm just wondering if Mr. Lindell or Ms. Robb, if either of you can break down for each of these boards, do we have a lack of people interested in serving? And for each board, it may be a different answer. A lack of people interested in serving or a lack of people who are getting appointed? And that's two different questions. Some of these professions have a lot of people in them, so I just want to see where we're at in terms of willingness to be appointed versus getting appointed. And it may be different for each board.
Through the chair to Representative Carrick, I know for the Board of Real Estate Appraisers, there was indications or testimony from the board members that there is a lack of interest in serving. I know that some boards have kind of canvassed other professionals to see if they're interested in serving. So I think there is some of that. I'm not sure the exact criteria that the boards and commissions director uses when they evaluate applicants, and that's something that's not within the scope of our audit, is to determine how many applications are received by the Office of the Governor, boards and commissions. But maybe Director Robb has more information on how that process works. But I can't really speak to that portion of the process.
Director Robb?
Through the chair to Representative Carrick, people who are interested in serving on our boards make an application directly to boards and commissions, which is part of the governor's office, not to the division. And then the selection process is undertaken by boards and commissions. So we don't have a great deal of insight into that, and so aren't the best ones to answer questions on that. I will just take the opportunity, though, to say that, we really appreciate our board members serving on these boards is an undertaking, and many people may envision a couple hour meeting four times a year, and it's a lot more work than that. And so we are extremely grateful to all of our people who are willing to serve on the board. So a huge thank you to all of them.
I could not agree more, Director Robb. And I would like to note for the committee's awareness, I missed this previously, but we do have the board chair for the Board of Professional Counselors online and available for questions. It's Ms. Crystal Herring. Do any committee members under this discussion have questions for Ms. Herring?
I just have a comment.
Representative Carrick?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just to follow up on that discussion, whether it's part of this bill, which is about board extensions, or a separate conversation, I do think it would be helpful if boards and commissions, somebody representing boards and commissions, could try to come before us, or at least we could ask them to. It strikes me as concerning that we have these very high volume of licensees professions on some of these boards, and yet we have vacant positions for the board. I know it's difficult to recruit volunteers. I know it's challenging to serve on the boards. I respect people willing to do so. I would just note that my office looked into all of the appointees that were referred to this committee in a pretty great degree of detail, and there is not one singular appointee this year who's not a registered Republican, and I don't care if they're registered Republicans or not, but I just wonder if someone from boards and commissions could speak to the lack of people serving on boards in some areas, and whether that is due to people not being interested in serving or people not being qualified by the requirements that maybe the boards and commissions is looking at people from. So it's not really relevant to this bill. I do think it's relevant to some of our boards and their functioning, though. And perhaps that's something we could at least ask as a committee to hear more about.
Representative Carrick, that suggestion is very welcome, because I have questions as well for those who help appoint the boards and commissions. Additionally, I have another question. Do you have any comments, Representative? Okay. I'm curious, how much are these licenses for this particular board? What is that fee?
Co-Chair Hall, excuse me. We have a schedule of fees.
see the schedule of revenues and expenditures.
Page 8, Exhibit 4.
I see.
Here we go.
Could you, or perhaps Director Robb, whoever it makes the most sense, walk through the items that are listed here?
Sure. Co-Chair Hall, we have Exhibit 4 shows the license and certification fees for the Board of Professional Counselors. There's an application fee for initial license, $200. License fees for all are part of the initial biennial license period, $250. The biennial license fee is $250 and a supervisor fee of $150.
Thank you very much. I think that's important for the record to reflect that and for the listening public to be aware of as well. Additional questions from the committee on this particular board? Seeing none, we can move on.
Okay. The next board is the Board of Certified Real Estate Appraisers. The audit recommends the legislature extend the board's termination date 6 years to June 30, 2032. If you turn to page 8, you'll see our discussion about how board statutes may not fully comply with federal law for this board. This board is subject to federal oversight by a federal appraisal subcommittee, which reviews each state's appraiser and appraisal management company regulatory programs for compliance with federal law. These reviews occur at least every 2 years. Exhibit 2 shows the federal findings issued in 2024, and the findings indicate that statutory changes are necessary to align state law with federal requirements for these programs. According to the board chair, legislation addressing the findings has not been introduced because the board has been unable to find a legislative sponsor. The schedule of licensing activities on page 10, Exhibit 3, as of January 2025, there were 362 active licenses, registrations, and certificates for this board. On page 12, Exhibit 5 is the schedule of the revenues and expenditures showing a surplus of $86,000 as of January 2025. There are three recommendations starting on page 13. The first is we recommend the boards and commissions director continue to work with the board to identify applicants to fill the board seats. The audit found that the general appraiser seat has been vacant for 56 months. Recommendation 2 is that the board should continue to seek a statutory change to address the federal appraisal subcommittee findings. And recommendation number 3 is that the DCCD commissioners should work with policymakers to improve the recruitment and retention of investigators. The audit reviewed 5 board-related cases that had been open for over 180 days and found unjustified periods of inactivity in each of the 5 cases. The inactivity ranged from 165 days to 575 days. Turnover and vacancies contributed to the delays, and one period of 575 days was due to untimely board member review. Management's response, the Office of the Governor and DCCD's commissioner and the board chair all concur with the conclusions and recommendations.
Mr. Lundell, we have a question from Representative Freer.
Okay.
Thank you. I wasn't sure if I heard that there was a recommendation to adjust the license fees. However, I would note on page 12, sorry, through the chair, and the ending cumulative surplus or deficit, the 2024-2025 period is significantly less than the previous fiscal years. I'm just curious if that's licensing fees, if that's, I see that there's indirect, well, no. What would cause that much of a decrease in the ending cumulative surplus?
Through the chair to Representative Freer.
Freer,
I'm sorry. I apologize. There could be reasons such as a investigation that may have cost more money would increase expenditures in a given fiscal year. which could impact the bottom line, the surplus or the deficit. As Director Rob mentioned, there's a spike when the biennial renewal happens, a spike in revenue, so that could create a fluctuation in the fund balance or the surplus or deficit at the end of a fiscal year. Those are two potential reasons that would cause that to happen. Are you...
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to ask you if you were looking at Exhibit 5 on page 12 for appraisers?
Correct, yeah.
And which year were you asking about?
Well, 24-25, so FY25. It's just the end of year's 86,278.
Oh, the...
And the previous years were...
Through the chair. That is a partial year.
Okay.
Because our period, our scope period ended January 31st.
And that's based on the fiscal year starting July 1.
Yes.
Yep. Okay.
Co-Chair Hall, the 22, 23, and 24 are full fiscal years.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification.
Thank you. Okay. Further questions from the committee?
Okay. The next board is the Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associate Examiners. The audit recommends the legislature extend this board's termination date 5 years to June 30, 2031. We recommended a 5-year extension to help ensure corrective action is taken to address deficiencies. On page 6, Exhibit 2 shows the board's schedule of licensing activity, and as of January 2025, the board had 371 active licenses. On page 7, we explain that board fees were not sufficient to cover the cost of operations. DCBPL did a fee analysis which showed that fees should be increased. However, management chose not to present the board the fee analysis in a timely manner due to the reasons we had discussed earlier. Fearing that there would be delays in the approval process, management determined they wanted to prioritize other fee increases for new license types. On page 8, Exhibit 3, you'll see the board's schedule of revenues and expenditures, which shows that the board had a deficit of just over $91,000 as of January 2025. This audit had 5 recommendations, which begin on page 11. The first is that the boards and commissions director work with the board to identify potential applicants to fill board seats and ensure qualified applicants are appointed in a timely manner. The public member and the psychological associate examiner member board seat had been vacant for 13 months, and we noted that the psychologist board seat was vacant for 33 months, both before and during the audit period. Recommendation 2 on page 13, the board chair and DCBPL director should work together to ensure renewal applicants comply with continuing education regulations or seek a regulatory change if necessary. The audit found that all license renewal applicants were not reporting the details regarding their continuing education as required by regulation. Recommendation number 3 on page 14, board members should review investigative cases in a timely manner. The audit reviewed 2 board cases that had been open for over 1,000 days and found one had an unjustified period of inactivity totaling 656 days. The delay was attributed to a board member not completing their review in a timely manner and a lack of alternate qualified board members to review the case. Recommendation 4 is that DCBPL's director should ensure courtesy licensees comply with monthly reporting requirements. We reviewed 4 courtesy licensees and found that 2 of the 4 were not submitting monthly reports indicating the number of days that they practiced during the month. And the final recommendation for this board is that DCBPL's director should ensure that board fees cover the cost of regulating the profession. Management's response to the audit begins on page 27, and each of the governor's office, DCCD commissioner, and the board chair concurred with the findings from the audit. The final audit is the real estate commission. Our audit recommends the legislature extend the commission's termination date 4 years to June 30, 2030. On page 10, Exhibit 3 is the Commission's schedule of licensing activity. As of January 2025, there were 2,854 licenses and 591 real estate office registrations. Page 11, Exhibit 4 is the schedule of revenues and expenditures, which shows the Commission had a surplus of $807,000 as of January 2025. This audit had 5 recommendations that begin on page 17. The first is that DCBPL's director provide training and update written procedures to ensure that minutes are prepared for all commission meetings as required by law. Our audit found that DCBPL staff were not recording minutes for committee meetings. Recommendation two is that the commission chair should update regulations and forms to include independent contractors. The audit observed that the real estate industry has evolved away from employment relationships, and licensees are typically independent contractors affiliated with brokerages. The statutes were updated in 1998 to reflect this industry change, but the commission never updated its forms and regulations, or its forms and regulations. Number three, recommendation three, is that the DCCD commissioner should work with policymakers to improve recruitment and retention of investigators, and management should consider ways to assist the commission in clearing its investigative backlog. This audit reviewed 14 cases and determined that all 14 cases had unjustified periods of inactivity ranging from 160 to 726 days with an average delay of 14 months. There were three types of delay, with many cases showing multiple types. First, the longest periods of inactivity related to DCBPL, waiting for a commission member to accept a case for review. Then commission members took a long time to complete their review, and the third was due to vacancies and turnover. Recommendation four is that the commission should consider seeking legislation to eliminate the Real Estate Recovery Fund. The Real Estate Recovery Fund was established to provide a remedy for loss suffered in a real estate transaction because of fraud, intentional tort, or deceit. Since 2018, state law has required licensees to have errors and omissions insurance. Since that law passed, and through January 2025, the recovery fund has paid only $50,000 in claims while collecting over $640,000 in recovery fund fees from licensees. If you look at page 14, we have an exhibit 6, which shows that there were virtually no claims paid out of the fund during our audit period. In short, the fund has outlived its usefulness. And the final recommendation, the commission should require license renewal applicants to submit a certificate of errors and omissions insurance coverage or seek a statutory change. Management's response to the audit begins on page 31, and the commissioner of DCCD and the board chair concurred with the report's recommendation. That is all of the audits.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lundahl. Before we turn to the committee for questions, I'm going to pivot to public testimony. Public testimony is now open. Is there anybody in the room who'd like to testify? Not seeing any. I'll turn on online. The only folks I see online are here to help answer questions. So with that, I will close public testimony. Okay, online to help answer questions, as previously mentioned, we have Ms. Crystal Herring with the Board of Professional Counselors. We have Ms. Ann Wells, who's the chair of the Board of Social Work Examiners, and we have Erin Johnson, who's the chair of the Psychologists and Psychological Associates. Do members of the committee have any questions for those mentioned? Okay. Yep. Representative Carrick, you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I think this is still for Mr. Lindahl. The Real Estate Commission, I don't think I've ever seen this comment in an audit report before, that the Real Estate Commission duplicated some activities of a trade association. Is this relating to funds for continuing education or certification? Like, can you elaborate on that a little bit more?
Sure. Through the chair to Representative Carrick. The Real Estate Commission, real estate professionals are regulated, can be regulated both at state and federal levels. Many of the real estate professionals are members of that that trade association. However, it's not a requirement for real estate professionals practicing in the state of Alaska to be a member. But it is required to be licensed through DCBPL's Occupational Licensing Board or Real Estate Commission. So even though there's some crossover, and it does relate to some training and education because of the requirement, specific requirement in Alaska to be licensed through the Real Estate Commission, we did not conclude that the duplication was it's a kind of a net positive. It's not necessarily a negative thing.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying. I have another
question, Madam
Representative Carrick?
I think it's, did you say that we have the chair of the psychologists and psychologicalists, Sam?
We do. We have Ms. Erin Johnson, who's the chair of the psychologists and psychological associates.
I'd like to ask Ms. Johnson through the co-chair about the deficit that the board is now facing, and I'm trying to pull it up in front of me, but did the board prior to Governor Dunleavy's chief of staff sending this letter of memorandum have any intention of doing a fee change or increase?
Ms. Johnson?
Yes, thank you. And through the chair, we were not privy to any fee increase recommendations prior to after the renewal period.
Follow-up, Representative Carrick?
So I guess as a follow-up through the co-chair, I'm just trying to understand that now we have a $300,000 decrease, more or less, between FY22 and today, where there's a cumulative deficit. And what steps did the board or does the board currently hope to take to rectify that deficit?
Thank you. And yes, through the chair, we have approved the fee increase for the subsequent renewal period.
Do you have a follow-up, Representative Carrick?
Well, I guess, Madam Co-Chair, so the fee increase has been approved in that. How, I guess. I'm a little confused about how that was able to be approved. It was approved through the governor's office directly?
That I would have to go back and look at the meeting minutes and maybe defer to Director Robb.
Director Robb, could you help answer this question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Sylvan Robb. Through the chair to Representative Carrick, so the fee increase for the Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associate Examiners has been approved and is currently, as I noted earlier, our fees are required to be set in regulation, and so that regulation project updating the fee is currently with the Department of Law.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
And I guess one more question. Sorry.
Representative Carrick.
Madam Co-Chair, as a follow-up, what does the, with the fee increase, is that projected to resolve the current deficit in this board, and by how much? Will we be at a net positive again after a year of the fee increase?
Through the chair to Representative Carrick. Again, because of the nature of the changes in revenue that swing quite a bit from one year to another. It depends on the point where the fee increase actually takes effect. If we're able to catch folks as they're going into renewal and so getting quite a bit of revenue from that. Additionally, depending on the size of the deficit and the number of licensees, we don't always strive to remove a deficit in one year. We're trying for stability in licensing fees, and so if it takes a little bit of time to resolve a deficit, we don't want to constantly be, you know, let's increase fees to get out of deficit. Oh, whoops, now we have too much revenue. Let's lower fees. So we're really striving to give some predictability to our professional licensees.
Makes perfect sense, and I trust the boards and the division to do that a lot more. Just as a comment, Madam Co-Chair, I trust the boards and the division to do that a lot more than I trust the governor's office. And so I just was caught off guard today hearing about that memo. I didn't know about it, and it troubles me that that was in place and is in place. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Carrick. I have a question, I believe, from Mr. Lindahl. Thank you, Director Robb. Mr. Lindahl, based on your expertise and experience, is there anything in these six board renewals or audits that you find highly unusual?
Co-Chair Hall, I don't think there's anything really that unusual in these findings. I think It's pretty consistent. Two of the boards had 8-year extensions. We would consider those pretty clean. Two had 6. Though a 5-year and the 4-year had the findings were a little more severe. A couple of them need statute changes to fix, eliminating the real estate recovery fund, and then the federal appraisal subcommittee bring in state statutes into alignment with federal law. So those are pretty important findings. But overall, no, I didn't think there was anything that different.
Okay. Additional questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you very much for your time and for being in front of the committee. With that, we are, Mr. Jackson, do you have any closing comments you'd like to share? No? Okay. With that, we're going to set this bill aside and set an amendment deadline for Tuesday, April 7th at 5 p.m. With that, the third bill before us today is in its second hearing, and that is for SB 89, Physician Assistant Scope of Practice. It is sponsored by Senator Tobin. I see Ms. Mackenzie Pope in the audience here. Will you please come to the table, introduce yourself for the record, and provide us a brief reminder of what this bill does?
For the record, Mackenzie Pope, staff to Senator Lukey Gail Tobin. She sends her apologies for not being able to be here. She is chairing Senate Education presently. You heard this bill before you on Monday. It is pertaining to physician assistant scope of practice and allowing them to work without a collaborative agreement if they are working at set defined locations as in the bill, mostly licensed by Department of Health or other qualified health centers.
Questions for Ms. Pope? Seeing none, with that, we are going to turn to public testimony. Public testimony is now open. I am not seeing anybody in the room who wants to testify. With that, we will go online, and we see that we have one person online for public testimony, Ms. Candace Hickel. Will you please introduce yourself to the committee and provide your testimony?
Thank you, members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee, for your time today. My name is Candace Hickel. I've been a PA in Anchorage for 18 years and currently work in cardiothoracic surgery. Today, I'm testifying in support of SB 89. I feel that the current bill strikes a balance for involved stakeholders and supports modernization towards better access to excellent health care in Alaska. We've heard prior testimony from at least 2 rural health care administrators that collaborative agreements are a barrier to patient care in Alaska. The collegial meetings held over this last summer between PA leadership and local physician organizations have come to the agreement that we all believe in physician-led healthcare teams. In this current version of the bill, that is reflected in allowing PAs who work in settings defined in Section 17 of the bill that include facilities directed by a licensed physician, a healthcare facility licensed by the Department of Health, a healthcare facility operated by the federal government or tribal organization, a federally qualified healthcare center or rural health clinic, a military or veterans facility. These will not be required to have collaborative plans. This supports the intention to support physician-led healthcare in Alaska while removing unnecessary administrative burden to allow PAs to fill the much-needed gap for healthcare in Alaska. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Hickel. I am not seeing any questions for you, and I'm not seeing anyone else online to provide public testimony. With that, I will close public testimony. Okay. So this bill, we set an amendment deadline for SB 89 yesterday at March 31st at 3 p.m. No amendments were received. With that, Mr. Co-Chair, do I have a motion?
I move to report Senate Bill 89, Work Order 34-LS0063/L out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Okay. Seeing no objection, Senate Bill 89, Work Order 34-LS0063/L is reported out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes. With that, that concludes our business for today. We look forward with anticipation at some point in the next several weeks of hearing, rescheduling and hearing HB 324, virtual currency kiosks, and HB 292, Insurance Pediatric Neuropsych Disorders. With that, I just want to share a comment with the committee that I appreciate all of those who were here and remained for the duration of the committee. Your time is valued and appreciated. With that, the House Labor and Commerce Committee will next meet on Wednesday, April 6th at 3:15 p.m. This meeting is adjourned at 4:51 p.m.